How darn exciting.
Oh, thanks. How fun to be here.
What is that? That's called like the pre-interview patter. So would you introduce yourself, please, just for kicks?
I'm Anthony. I'm in a group called Anthony and the Johnsons.
You are. And you know, it's not even on my list here, but I realized I have not read anywhere about why. I mean, obviously you chose your name for, you know, the leader of, you know, like the Dave Clark Five. But how did you decide on the Johnsons?
I have this hero from New York. Her name was Marsha P. Johnson, and she was kind of the namesake for my group. She started a group in the early 70s called STAR, Street Transvestite Action Revolutionaries, and she was a street prostitute, and she created a group home for other kids that were on the street.
Wow.
And she was just characterized by her very good humor and sweetness of character. She was often called like Saint Marsha on the streets. And they found her in the Hudson River in 1992, and no one really knows why she died, but she kind of ascended into my pantheon of sort of heroes. Also, I like the fact that Johnson's is very American. I felt like we were doing very American work.
Interesting, because there's this amazing perception of it not being American work, and we can get to that. So when I was young, my dad played a lot of Ima Sumac around the house. I heard that before I heard rock and roll. And she was undefinable. And so it hit me today that journalists and interviewers need to stop categorizing your music, because no one categorizes Al Green or The Stones or Irma Thomas or anybody that has an original voice.
You know, I think it's double-edged. You know, on one hand, it's helpful for people to find a way into the music, or a way in mentally, you know, a way to start relating to it. On the other hand, if it starts to limit people's perception of it, then that can be problematic.
So I want to get to this early on, because it's been talked about so much. But, you know, as somebody who's around a lot of artists, you know, on a constant basis, I have my own theory about, you know, transgender and sexuality and all of that, which is really that it's innate not only to your existence, but it's more spiritual than it is physical.
But just to be clear, the last three songs I did, none of them really reference transgender.
Exactly.
So it's interesting that you're bringing that up. I think more than anything, it's kind of an American preoccupation, because right now, culturally, we're going through a transformation where, you know, for a whole lot of different reasons, more stories are coming to the table and people are becoming more aware about the diversity of in the family. So, you know, I think for me, it's just more, you know, people have been focusing a lot in recent interviews with me about, you know, the fact that I identify as transgender. I think just because there's a general inquiry in culture that has nothing to do with me, which is about what's a transgender person. And now we have the language to talk about it. Whereas 20 years ago, people were still struggling to frame it. You know, it hadn't differentiated enough from what a gay person was yet in popular language to really get a handle on it. But I don't know how much that really has to do with, I mean, it has lots to do with my work, but I almost separate the two issues in my mind, like myself as an artist and the American media's preoccupation with, and my own happy willingness to participate in that cultural evolution, you know, of just getting it out there. For a long time, people have, you know, had a kind of sensational, highly sexualized idea about what a transgender or transsexual person is, but the idea of settling down with an idea, even that it's a model of a child within a family, is a different idea. Is taking that kind of exploitive view of a trans, or a reductive view of a transgender person, and starting to embrace this notion of what a transgender person is within the family more expansively, and what they have to offer, and what the potential gifts that they can bring to the family are. I mean, that's a newer dialogue.
The Crying Light shows your fascination with several themes, but particularly your place in the world and the world's place in the universe at this point. So that's it. When you were recording it, which was, you know, a little while ago, did you know we'd be kind of living in the world where, I mean, the certain things were already happening, but so many things have coalesced over the past bunch of months that everything's kind of magnified. So were you aware that when this came out, it was going to be as relevant as it was?
Yeah, I think people are becoming more aware of, I think, you know, maybe it feels more intense now because because we're getting more consciousness about it. But it's not like the situation has become more intense. It's just that our dawning awareness of it has increased.
You first were going to do theater, and then you realized, and I'm paraphrasing what I've read, that the art you were going to make wasn't going to get as much support as you wanted. So the first album was, what, 12 years ago, 1997. So much for instant stardom, right?
Yeah, I had a long, interesting path in my life so far. You know, it's been really rewarding.
Back then, there wasn't really indie rock, you know, and yet you're on a, quote, label out of Bloomington, Indiana, which is you know, definitely supportive and wonderful and doing a great job, but kind of different. But your music does, the people who will come to your shows, if you look out on that audience, you know, it's a lot of the indie rock audience. It's a lot of audience that has come to a very different type of music. So does that surprise you? When you were putting out this music, did you think that was the audience that you were going to draw to it, and that was going to be the people buying the music?
It's been like a slow process, but it's like, you know, when I was making music in clubs, it was like I didn't expect that there'd be any audience for it, any popular audience for it. It wasn't something that I dared to really fantasize about. But it's been amazing to me. That's been probably like most kind of humbling revelation, really, of this whole process is finding the ways that the things that I share in common with so many other people, or the common ground that we can find in a dialogue with through work, you know, and from people from so many different demographics and so many different parts of the world, you know, it's been a real adventure.
Well, and it's true, because, you know, the first record showed up in the mail with a whole stack of things that didn't relate to it in any way, shape, or form. And then, actually, it was my producer at the time, who's British, who said, by the way, she kind of saw it on my desk, and she said, listen to that right now. You're you know, given the things that you played in the 80s, that you played Culture Club, you know, from day one, that you played that kind of stuff, that you were just going to go for it immediately. And I did. I didn't even do any reading. I just, you know, played it immediately. So that, I think that's pretty incredible that you can bring all those demographics together by the nature of your music and your art and what you're singing about. I mean, I think that's hasn't been done that often.
I mean, I think stylistically, the music, I mean, you can trace it pretty easily, you know, back to some kind of side projects of from New Wave, like Mark and the Mambas, and the things that inspired me when I was a kid, you know, and some of the more pastoral things that came out in the mid-80s, like This Mortal Coil and things like that, and then combined with, you know, a lot of American music that I ended up listening to, soul and jazz music. And I mean, I don't think the form is too unusual. You know, I think probably what people tend to identify some of the content as more idiosyncratic or whatever.
Well, yeah, I think the influences, I agree with you, but I think that the way you've taken your influences and put them inside you and then brought them back out is where it gets interesting. So I got a single, actually it was a white label single of Another World before the rest of the record, and all it had was a little one sheet and said, you know, the new single from Anthony and the Johnsons. And I went on the air, I popped it in the CD player, and I played it once, and the 4 minutes went by, and then I said, you know what, we all have to listen to this again. And I just hit it again. And I'm saying personally, I was just totally enveloped in the music. All my thoughts disappeared, and I just kind of visualized, you know, this different place. And it really affected me personally. So when you wrote it, were you aware that it, I mean, people hear this song and they just, I've watched it happen, they just grow silent and they become meditative, and it's just, you know, it's that beautiful to listen to, and yet what you're saying is so incredibly powerful. And I think that's the combination that makes it an amazing tune.
Well, you know, with that song, I had a pretty simple intention, actually, and it was just to try to articulate in as clear and as simple language as I could. And it was quite consciously done, as opposed to a lot of the songs that I write, they kind of like Rorschachs, and I kind of start figuring out what I'm doing later on. With this song, I really wanted to just articulate how I felt, you know, in relationship to this idea about changing ecology, and sit with the feeling of it, you know, because in the past I've tended to, you know, when I, it's some, the emotion of that has been something that's in the past over the last 10, 15 years sort of sent me into panic or denial or kind of obsessive fear. And, you know, and I just wanted to sit with some of the grief that I was feeling, that I wasn't really letting myself go there. And so I thought, you know, just as I've gotten older and watching people in their emotional process, sometimes grief is a useful thing to move through, can bring you to a new place. Or so I thought, well, let me try this, you know. And people, I got some feedback with that song where people were like, there's no hope in that song. This is the first song I ever heard you write that really makes me feel hopeless. And that was a challenge for me, because I could kind of agree with them in a way, but then I realized that the hope in the song is the gesture of moving through the feeling, you know. For me, is the hope that there's something on the other side of that feeling. And I always want to explain to people, you know, it's a feeling, it's not a fact, you know what I mean? And it's a creative exploration, you know, I mean.
I didn't even realize until I really did all the research, I didn't know you did that Hercules vocal 6 years ago.
Yep.
Oh my gosh. So you did that 6 years ago and voila, there it comes, and it gives your audience a whole nother perspective, right? The dance side.
Yeah, well, he was a good, you know, Andy's a good friend of mine. And so we just, we were just messing around. You mentioned Alison Moyet. Like, my whole idea was just to do my best Alison Moyet impersonation, you know, because I loved Yazoo so much as a kid. It was like some of the first music I ever heard that really made me cry was listening to Alison Moyet singing Nobody's Diary. You know, I remember being 12 years old and just like glued to the radio in my grandmother's house, just like crying. And I was like, why am I feeling this way? I don't even know what this is. You know, it was this feeling of nostalgia, but for something that I didn't remember. It was just, I remember it was the first time I ever had a real feeling listening to music, and I was shocked. She's got so much humility about it, really. She doesn't, you know, it's like, I think neither of them were really aware of the extent of their impact of those two records.
Well, because they were together for so little time.
Yeah, and I just don't think they really ever got the feedback, because I think those are two of the most seminal albums of that period.
Yeah, no, I mean, that stuff gets into my head and you just go,
it's
just
so
go
emotional
crazy.
Because the singing was so hardcore and so heart-wrenching, and the songwriting was so bulletproof. It was like really beautiful, really beautiful, and so authentic.
So I'm going to skip all the other stuff, because it's stuff that's been covered. What have you not been, this is a silly question, but I do it only once in a while. What have you not been asked in an interview that you wish someone would actually ask you?
Well, you know, I mean, I guess I just would have a little statement, you know, which is more like, I don't know if it's a question. It's just recently I've been thinking the focus, I think it's perverse, the extent to which people focus on the artist, you know. I think, you know, really it's about the work. And the work all comes from the same place. And it's like, you know, the work is a gift, you know, and it's a boon. It's what like Nina Simone would have called a boon. And it's everyone has access to it, and everyone's just plucking it out, and everyone's the same, you know. Not everyone's the same, but, you know, I think people really get into this thing where they fetishize it's like blaming the messenger, or like people fetishize the window for bringing them the sky. It's like, it's not about the window. You know, we're just a bunch of idiots just like doing the same thing that everyone else is doing, trying their best, putting the best foot forward, you know. But it's about the common dialogue, not about this like obsessive focus on the artist. I think something flipped over maybe in the last 100 years or so or maybe it's been longer than that. I don't know. That's what I think about, you know.
Now, we're not looking at the breath. So because it's true, when people spend their time looking at Warhol or Waters or whatever, they spend so much time on the individual making it and not on the fact that in the case of Waters, he was smart enough to cast people, you know, like Divine and, you know, all these people that were just unusual people. But that was not him. That was the work. That was the breath of the work he was doing.
And it's in relationship. I mean, you can't separate. You know, it's all a response and in relationship to the culture around it. You know, it's like trying to take the sun out of the sky, you know, trying to take the sky out of the sun. It's like, it's almost, you know, there would be an argument that could be made that it's made by the community. The all work made is made by the community. It's a part, it's everyone's participating in dialogue with ourselves, you know, in our own ways, you know, each person through the lens of their own experience. But at the end of the day, it's not that personal experience that's really that's not the source.
We do a thing called a musical sandwich, and what it is two of your songs is the bread, and then songs by other things in between.